With great power comes great responsibility.
Compromise where you can. Where you can't, don't. Even if everyone is telling you that something wrong is something right, even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye and say no, you move.
Never step onto the battlefield of ideas unprepared. Before you enter the fray, you need a plan. And there's no better place to get one than right here on Tactics with host Caleb Colquitt. The Situation Room goes live now on News Radio 1440.
And welcome in, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to the Situation Room here on Tactics, where speech isn't violence, tolerance isn't love, and disagreement isn't hate. Thank you so much for being with us, whether you're joining us on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Twitch, Periscope, however you're joining us on the program, we certainly appreciate you being with us this afternoon. Lots of news to get to. I know I was gone most of last week. I know that it's been very hectic schedule-wise. That really is just because it's welcome week here at Faulkner University. My other jobs kept me very busy. But we are going to go over as much news as humanly possible, and we jump into it right now. The first big news story that I wanted to talk about is that there are dozens, and I mean dozens, of people rallying in Birmingham for red flag laws. That was reported by AL.com, which if they're saying dozens, what they probably mean is somewhere less than 200, because if it was over 200, it would be hundreds, not dozens, which means realistically 199 people or less, probably significantly less. And this is in a city, Birmingham, which is by far the most liberal city in the state of Alabama. And I'm guessing if it's less than 200, we know that the population of Birmingham is, according to the latest census, about 217,000. Which means that in this city, a little less than 0.01% of the population probably showed up to this rally, being the bluest city in the state of Alabama, arguably. I don't know if it's necessarily the bluest in the sense of per capita, but it certainly got the most Democrats, the most liberal voters. And so even in a deep, deep blue city like Birmingham, you only had really under 200 people showing up for red flag laws. And we're going to get into the merits of red flag laws and which one this was particularly pertaining to in a second. But before we do that, I really want to sort of do an overview as to why is it in a city like Birmingham that you had so few people showing up for a rally for red flag laws. And this is put together by Moms Demand Action, which is a subsidiary, a group that was started by Everytown for gun safety, which is a multi-billion dollar industry, a multi-billion dollar nonprofit that is run by Mayor Bloomberg. It's the biggest anti-gun advocacy group in the country. Why is it that they were able to organize so few people to a rally in the park when it comes to gun violence? And I get that this is an isolated incident, and I'm trying not to read too much into it. But I do think that this speaks to a truism that for the vast majority of the Southeast, there is an aversion to gun control, even amongst blue voters. A lot of those people, they may believe in the welfare state, they may believe in really big taxes, they may even believe in things like distribution of wealth and full-on socialism. But there is a difference in the state of Alabama and the state surrounding us in the way that we view guns. There's a couple of different reasons for that. One of them, I think, was hinted at by Condoleezza Rice, because what's one thing that most of the urban areas in the South have in common as opposed to a lot of the urban areas in the North? Well, with the exception of a few cities like Baltimore, Detroit, and Chicago, there isn't a prevalent black population. That's true of every city in the South. And I'm sitting in a city right now in Montgomery, Alabama, that 70% of the population is black. Whites are actually a minority in this city. And the demographic breakdown isn't quite that drastic in Birmingham, but still, there's an awful lot of black people living in Birmingham. And there is a difference in a lot of the black voters in the way that they view guns and view gun control in the South as opposed to the North. A big reason for this, I think, was pointed out by Condoleezza Rice, who's somebody that knows this culture. Her family's from Alabama. And one of the things that she pointed out is when there were Jim Crow laws and there were people that legitimately wanted to harm them simply for having black skin, that that her father and other fathers in the neighborhood used guns to keep themselves safe. And the reason that she says, even though she's not one of the more conservatives of the Republican thinkers, she has said that the reason that she's against, for example, a national gun registry is because she can very easily see how that could have been abused by people in power in the South under Jim Crow. And so there is a different relationship that black voters, even Democrat black voters in the South, have with guns than their Northern counterparts. And I think that's part of the reason. I don't think it's the only reason. Because I've even talked to liberals here in the South that are white, whether they're Dixiecrats or whether they're full-on love socialism, love Marxism. Granted, there's not many of those down here, but they do exist. Even a lot of those guys don't have a problem with guns. I'm thinking about three people in my head in particular, two of which are self-proclaimed socialists, one who's a little bit more moderate, but tend to vote pretty much right down the line Democrat. Not a single one of them likes gun control. And these are not older people. These are not Dixiecrats. These guys are very far left progressive thinkers. But because they've been in the South, they've grown up around the South, they have a different relationship when it comes to firearms. They understand the value of having an armed populace. Now, some of the ideas that they have on other situations, I would say, conflict with that when it comes to some of their issues of authoritarian government versus small government, that sort of thing. But the point is, they do see the inherent value of people being armed and having guns in case the government does go rogue. And as much as I disagree with them on some of their policies when it comes to things like socialism or like a big centralized government, I have to admit that socialism is far less dangerous. And even though I believe that it will necessarily become tyrannical, it's far less likely to become tyrannical, or at least not as tyrannical, if you have a population that is armed with firearms. And so that is a big difference in worldview, and that really affects why this is the case. But as per the usual, when it comes to gun control arguments, most of these were emotionally charged and had virtually nothing to do with whether or not these laws would actually help save any lives or protect anyone. Here's a good example of this. This is from Onoyima Williams, who was at the event. He represents Peacekeepers of Birmingham. And he said, quote, "Birmingham, how do we stop our concrete streets from bleeding?" Again, powerful imagery, an emotional tug. Do you see a solution in there? Do you see a proposal that would actually affect change? This is the problem when it comes to most of the gun control advocates, is that they never make arguments that have anything to do with, okay, will they work? It's just, it makes them feel good to take guns away because they believe they're making people safer. They're not. It's not effective. The statistics bear that out. Like I said last week, there are a lot of political issues where I can kind of see both sides of the argument. I have a strong stance and a strong opinion one way or the other, but I can at least see where the other person is coming from. There are at least some statistics, some facts on the other side. Guns are not one of those issues. I mean, you look at it, statistic after statistic after statistic, study after study, anyone that's not done specifically with the intent before it ever starts to try to skew in favor of gun control, any study that's done honestly comes out on the side of guns either having no effect on crime or violence or having a positive effect. And what I mean by that is there's actually less crime or less violence in a place where they're more liberal with that. Now, here's another quote by the same guy. "In addition to that, we have to look at those who are picking up illegal guns. What is making them think they have nothing else to lose?" Now, this one I found really interesting because I think this guy accidentally told the truth. And what I mean by that is, listen to it again. In addition to that, we have to look at those who are picking up illegal guns. In addition to that. So what you're saying is the proposals that you're there to vouch for, this particular bill that we're going to get into some of the intricacies of it in a moment, you're admitting that this particular bill will do absolutely nothing for those who are picking up illegal guns, which the vast majority of gun crimes occur with. Now, recently we've had some mass shootings that took place with people that had no criminal record, that passed a background check, and they got their guns legally. But that's not always the case. About half the time, and this is just based on my own research that I did about a year ago, so it may have been updated since then, but roughly half the time when you're talking about mass shooting incidents, about half the time they were gained legally, about half the time they were gained illegally. That's not true when it comes to gun homicides or other forms of gun crime, when we're not talking about mass shooting incidents. When you're looking at gun crime, the vast overwhelming majority are illegal guns. And here's a guy who's accidentally being honest, saying, okay, well, what we're talking about today, the legislation that we're pushing for in the form of this red flag law, that has nothing to do with illegal guns. Yeah, that's true. That's 100% true. That wouldn't affect the sale or the underground black market when it comes to guns at all. Wouldn't do a dang thing to prevent it. But that's where the vast majority of gun violence is coming from. So even though I don't think he was doing it intentionally, he accidentally admitted that the reason they were there had nothing to do with illegal guns, wouldn't do one thing to stop it. They're not focused on the people that are getting guns illegally. They are focused on taking guns away from the law-abiding citizen, and that's what he just accidentally admitted to. Look at the next line of that quote. What is making them think they have nothing else to lose? That I'm actually not necessarily against, because that actually addresses the person, not the gun. If we're talking about trying to come up with a system, trying to come up with a method to get people that are in desperation and feel like the only thing that they have left is to go and kill a bunch of people and get famous and go down in a blaze of glory, yeah, if we're addressing that, yeah, all in favor of that. But you just admitted that nothing that you were talking about at this rally that day had anything to do with addressing that problem. Basically, their stance, their method is, we're going to take care of, in other words, we're going to pass this legislation that deals only with taking guns away from law-abiding citizens, and then we'll worry about the illegal guns later. If you're really concerned about curbing gun violence, shouldn't you focus on the illegal guns first, and then, even though I don't think you should, and then once that problem is more or less handled, then think about maybe adjusting gun control laws with law-abiding citizens? They don't want to do that. They're coming after the law-abiding citizen's gun because they can't figure out a way to do something about the people that are getting guns illegally. Why don't we focus on that? Because that is something that both sides agree is something that needs to be taken care of. But that's not their priority because it doesn't help them politically. All right, so surrounding the Gun Violence Protective Order Act, that's what this whole thing was surrounding. That's what the whole rally was about. They were supporting the Gun Violence Protective Order Act, which was considered by the Alabama legislature this past run. It's probably going to get brought up again in 2020. Of course, they've ended their session for 2019. So unless the governor calls a special session of the legislature, then what they're going to do is they might pick it up in 2020. I don't think that there's any support, anywhere near enough support in the state of Alabama to make this thing actually have legs and go somewhere. So I don't think we really have anything to worry about when it comes to this. But it's important to talk about it just because there are other states that are considering this, and we'll get into this in a bit, it's actually being considered on a national level. Back in 2017, we basically copy and pasted the law that was being proposed at the federal level in 2017 and copied that down to be under consideration now. So this law is modeled after other states' red flag laws. And this thing is an absolute nightmare just going through it. Essentially what a red flag law is, it is a way to see somebody that has a red flag, in other words, a warning sign that they may do something crazy, commit a mass shooting, something like that, and then take the guns away. In theory, I don't have a problem with this. in theory, if there were a way to definitively know ahead of time that there are warning signs and this person needs to have their firearms taken away, that would be fine. But I'm going to explain to you why that's a lot harder said than done. And this particular one, I mean, it is an absolute mess. Because a family member or law enforcement can basically say, I have reason to believe I am suspicious that this person might commit a crime in the future, ergo we need to take the guns away from them. And so the way that this one works is that they go in, they confiscate the guns once a complaint is levied, and then in 2 weeks you go back before a court and you make the case as to essentially why you're not a danger to yourself or others and why you should be allowed to have your firearms back. That is fraught with all kinds of constitutional dangers, and it is a absolutely abhorrent law to anybody that values not just the Second Amendment, but liberty in general. I mean, it's a violation of the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment. There are all kinds of reasons why this is an issue. It completely ignores due process, and the way that it works is essentially they take your guns first, ask questions later. So because they're saying, well, we need to, in case this threat happens to be real, just in case, we need to go ahead and take their guns away, and then we'll decide whether or not they actually need them back. There are all kinds of reasons why this is an issue. First of all, when looking at the process that takes, a lot can happen in 2 weeks. A lot can happen in 2 weeks. Let's say that they do this to a woman, and in that two-week period, she is assaulted. I mean, you could say the same thing for a man as well. I mean, he could be killed by a burglar or anything else, but when it comes to women, the number one determining factor, and I've used this stat so many times because it makes a difference, the number one determining factor whether or not an attempted rape is completed, in other words, the rapist actually achieves his goal in raping the woman that he's targeting, the number one determining factor is, was she armed? They looked at all kinds of different things in the study, whether she was running away, whether she called for help, had a rape whistle on her, the kind of area that she was in. The number one determining factor that determined whether or not the rape was completed or not is whether or not she was armed. Now, the arming part could have been with a knife, with a gun, but the point is, having a weapon is that number one determining factor. And that goes from about 50% of rapes being completed, brings it all the way down to less than 1%. So it's not just the number one determining factor, it's an incredibly wide dearth between having nothing and having a weapon on you. So, I mean, think about that. Yeah, 2 weeks may not seem like a lot to you, but a lot can happen in 2 weeks. And hopefully nothing does, but something could. And then that person would essentially be victimized by a crime that could have been prevented had the state not just assumed that they were dangerous. Let's couple that with knowledge that the person is unarmed. So let's just say that this person in question, who has had their weapons taken away from them, that somebody overhears them talking about it. Well, then the muggers or the assailants automatically know that that person doesn't have a gun. They know that it's illegal for them to even be carrying one, and so they know that they're an easy target. Let's make it a little bit more real, something that's a little bit more likely to happen. Let's say that the assailant is the one that issued the claim. Let's put this into a real-world scenario. Let's say that there is an abusive husband, and his wife happens to be a gun enthusiast and owns a few guns. Well, let's say that she wants to divorce him. So what he does is he goes and issues the complaint because he is a family member. He issues the complaint to have her guns taken away, and they say, okay, the complaint's been issued. We'll settle this in 2 weeks. Go in, take her guns. And they do. Well, in that 2 weeks, he knows that she's not armed. I mean, God knows what that person could do with that information. He would actually be able to use the government specifically to disarm his wife or ex-wife or girlfriend or whatever else it is in order that he would know that she wasn't armed and could do something to her. I mean, you hate to think about scenarios like that, but that's a very real possibility. And it just does showcase why that would be the case. Take it in the opposite direction. Let's say that the woman has a husband and she just wants to get back at him for some reason. She could have his guns taken away through that. Let's say that she's been fooling around and new boyfriend wants to, you know, get revenge on him or whatever. And she leaves husband for this guy. And then she issues a complaint, and then the other guy is free and clear to do whatever he wants because he knows that guy's not armed. We could take it from the stance, because remember, it's just suspicion. You don't actually have to go through a trial until 2 weeks later where you have to basically beg the government to have your guns taken back. And by the way, that also incurs all kinds of legal fees, also incurs all kinds of stress when it comes to getting the guns back. You actually have to pay a storage fee to the government under most of these red flag laws. Even though you may be cleared, you still have to pay the fee. You still have to pay to have your gun stored for those 2 weeks, even though the claim against you was proven to be false. That's still a consideration. Let's say that you've got a liberal kid or a liberal grandkid, something like that, and they just frankly don't like the fact that you have guns, and you get into a heated political discussion with them. Well, now they have an avenue to go ahead and take your guns away. And this really goes back to one of the big issues that I have with the law as a whole. First of all, due process completely ignored here. There is no due process. They go ahead and confiscate your guns just in case first, and then due process ensues 2 weeks later. To have an actual constitutional right taken away, due process should precede that. And then if they determine that you are a danger to yourself and other people, they can take it away. Not before. They don't just assume that you're wrong, take the guns from you, and then determine whether or not you're allowed to have them back 2 weeks later. That's absurd. You don't preemptively take away a right without having due process first. Now, the second half of this is that it essentially operates under the presumption of guilt. They're not assuming that you're innocent, they're assuming that you're guilty, thus removing your rights and your firearms from you, and then you have to go back and beg the government on your hands and knees, please restore my rights to me. That's the exact opposite of one of the cornerstones of our judicial system. Our justice system always starts with the idea that you are innocent until proven guilty. This starts with the premise that you are guilty until you can prove to us that you're innocent and you can be trusted with your rights. That's the exact opposite of the way that this is supposed to function. And furthermore, if you're going to follow this train of thought down to its logical conclusion, if we can just willy-nilly take away rights just in case the person might be a danger to somebody, if that's the new standard, why don't we just go ahead and imprison people? Because isn't that what prison is? You have freedom of movement, you have freedom to own firearms, freedom of speech. Those things are all abridged in prison, and the reason those things are abridged is because you have proven to society that you cannot be trusted to use your rights responsibly. And because of that, as a last resort, when there is no other choice and a person has violated the law, then that person is incarcerated. So my question is, if we're just going to go ahead and, just in case, take away somebody's rights, why specifically single out the Second Amendment? Why not just take away a person's rights completely? If we just see that we're suspicious that somebody might be a danger to themselves or others, it would be far easier to determine that once they're in prison, wouldn't it? Where they're under 24-hour security, surveillance. Why don't we just throw them in jail, not worry about the Second Amendment so much? Why don't we just throw them in jail for 2 weeks and then wait and see what they do? And then 2 weeks later, we have a trial to determine whether or not they actually should be in prison or not. We don't do that in this country. You have to have reasonable suspicion that a crime has been committed. That's the problem with these red flag laws. They're completely redundant. If somebody threatens a person, in other words, you straight up say that I'm going to kill you, I'm going to shoot you, that's already a crime. You can already have a person's guns removed from that. if somebody commits a violent offense, domestic violence, mugging, that kind of thing, you already have your guns taken away for that too. And so on that stuff, where they have actually proven that you've committed a crime, or there is at least a high level of reasonable suspicion, then yes, I can see why they would want somebody's guns taken away at that point. I want that person's guns taken away at that point. And I'm a card-carrying NRA member. But I don't want criminals having guns, and most NRA members feel the same way that I do. If you're an actual criminal that has actually committed a crime, not just they think you might commit a crime at some point in the future, this isn't Minority Report. We actually have seen you commit a crime. You've actually proven, beyond the shadow of a doubt, you are a danger to yourself and you can't be trusted with those liberties. If that's the case, then taking away the guns is fine. The red flag laws don't do that. Those things are already criminal offenses that you can already have your guns removed for. And so even in the ideal way that a red flag law could be crafted correctly, in my opinion, it would merely be redundant. And so that's really the issue. This really does go back to a difference in worldview. To people that actually see rights as God-given and inherent the way that the Declaration of Independence describes it, to people like me that see rights as something that is going to be inalienable and that you should only take away under the most extreme of circumstances, our position tends to be, this is an actual constitutional right granted to a person by God and recognized by the Constitution of the United States. Therefore, if we're going to take away somebody's right to own a gun, we better be darn sure that that's the only possible solution left. We've tried everything else, and the only reason that we're willing to even consider removing that person's right is that they have proven that they cannot be trusted with it. Generally speaking, the gun control advocates look at it the other way around. Well, guns are super scary and dangerous, so if there's even a shadow of a doubt, if there's even an inkling that they might commit a crime with them sometime in the future, then we need to go ahead and take it away just in case. That's not the way rights work in this country. And it really does highlight a difference in that worldview. And it goes back to something that Justice Clarence Thomas actually asked in court one time. He said, why is it, and I'm paraphrasing here, I'm not using a direct quote, but he said, why is it that the second is viewed as a lesser right? Why is it that we're so cavalier with the Second Amendment and to take away a person's rights when it comes to that one, but all the other ones, we wait to basically its last resort. In other words, we don't remove somebody's property. We don't imprison them. We don't take away their freedom of speech. We don't take away their freedom of assembly unless there is no other choice. And it's absolutely the last result. But with the second one, there's a certain portion of this country that basically says, oh, if you get a parking ticket, I mean, just any little bitty offense, you ought to automatically have your guns taken away. The reason that they believe that is because they don't think that people should have guns in the first place. That's what it all goes back to. And there are some people, rank and file Democrats, that they genuinely just are not well educated on this issue. Because in their mind, their ideas kind of line up more or less with the conservative viewpoint on it, that you should only take somebody's guns away if you have no other choice. But there is unfortunately a growing plurality in the Democrat base, and already just about everybody at the top of the Democrat Party believes that we should do everything to remove as many guns as possible. It's a flawed worldview. But speaking of that, and I know that you're going to just really pop your eyes up at it, but there is a reason that I'm going over this. We've been talking about this statewide, but actually there is a national tie-in here because Trump has recently been calling for red flag laws. It's part of the reason that this rally came up is because President Trump himself has been calling for red flag laws, and he had been pretty vague about it until he gave a little hint at what he was thinking about when he said red flag laws, and we'll get into that specific here in just a second. But he had been very vague about what that meant so far. Dan Crenshaw, representative from Texas, he's, for those of you who don't remember who he is, he's the guy with the eye patch. You've probably seen him on some of the networks talking. Dan Crenshaw, who is a veteran, I mean, he's a decorated military hero, has a Purple Heart, that's how he lost his eye. He has said that there may be a way statewide to do it right. Now, he's very much a 10th Amendment guy like I am, and so he doesn't think that at the federal level you can do anything, but at the state level, maybe looking at a red flag law isn't a bad idea. Now, hear me out on this, because I do trust Dan Crenshaw in the sense that I think that he's a good guy. He's a staunch believer in Second Amendment rights, and so I'm at least willing to consider exactly what he's saying on this with just a little bit more consideration than somebody who's not sort of in that camp. So not that I'm against hearing out the other side. I'm just saying that with Dan Crenshaw, he has a little bit more credibility on this subject than people on the left normally would. So basically he's saying that there's at least a possibility that these things can be done right. And I'm open to hearing the president's thoughts on this. I'm open to hearing what he has to say. I don't want to pass judgment before he gets specific into what the red flag laws would look like. But here's the three conditions that I would have to see in a red flag law to believe that it might actually be worth considering. First of all, it has to use correct due process. In other words, there would have to be a trial, a hearing, something before the guns are removed. You don't get to just take away a person's guns and then try to figure out whether or not they're worthy to have them back. You have to actually go through due process before there is a confiscation of property. And I think that that should also be true with civil asset forfeiture. This isn't necessarily just a gun thing, just a Second Amendment thing. I think that the same would be true with civil asset forfeiture. You can't just confiscate a person's property assuming that they're guilty and trying to figure out whether or not they're innocent. And that brings me to the second point. It has to use a presumption of innocence. We've turned that whole presumption of innocence on its head when it comes to these red flag laws. So if there is a way to presume that the person is innocent, and then that they, the party that is making the allegation that they're not safe, must prove to a court, prove to a jury or a judge or somebody, the burden of proof must be on them to prove to the court that they are indeed a danger to themselves and others. If that's done and there is that presumption of innocence, I'd at least be willing to hear what they have to say or how the red flag law would work. And it would also have to be not redundant. Now, this one's just more on a technical level. So, for example, if they wrote a law in Alabama, and I'm just going to give the layman's standard here so it's easy to understand, partly so I understand it. If they were to put out a law that said essentially, okay, if you threaten somebody with violence with a gun, then we can go ahead and start the process to take your guns away. Well, I wouldn't be opposed to that, but that would also already be a crime, so I don't see what the point of passing that law would be. So those are the three big qualifications for me. It has to start with the presumption of innocence, it has to involve due process, and it can't be redundant, because there's no point in passing it if it resembles a law that's already on the books that person would already have their guns taken away anyway. We saw this in the Parkland shooting, for example. Everybody was crying about our gun control laws and that we need to pass new gun control. In fact, I think that's the way that Florida's current red flag law wound up being put into place. Wouldn't have changed. Wouldn't have done a single thing to stop that maniac from going into that school and murdering those kids. Why? Because there were already laws on the books standing there right now. Both FBI and local law enforcement dropped the ball several different times. When it comes to government incompetence, you can't write a law that corrects that. The laws on the books were not followed. And if that's the case, then you can't blame the laws that currently exist and say, well, if we just pass new laws, if anything, it's a testament to how passing new laws isn't going to fix every problem. So far, out of all the red flag laws I've seen, and I think 34 states now have them, out of all the red flag laws that I've seen, not a single one meets even one of these three requirements. Not one. And that's the reason that I'm automatically skeptical of them. Willing to hear what the president has to say, willing to hear his suggestions. I'm just saying that he's going to have to go a very, very long way to convince me of that, because none of those red flag laws include those three requirements. And so far, there has been no statistic whatsoever that these or any other gun laws, red flag laws specifically or gun laws in general, inhibit crimes or reduce mass shootings. You look at some of the mass shootings that have happened just recently. Now, we could look at it at the statistical level, and it bears that out, too. One of the hotbeds for these mass shootings is in California and Texas. Two very different states with two very different gun laws. Why is that? Because they're bigger. That's really what it boils down to. It's because they're bigger. Just like there are far more mass shootings, and the left uses this argument all the time when they're talking about mass shootings, they'll say, well, yeah, but look how many more mass shootings there are in America a year as compared to Great Britain. Yeah, well, we have a population that dwarfs theirs many times over. Anytime you're looking at any kind of gun stats, you have to adjust for population. That's true of mass shootings, and that's true of any crime, gun crime or otherwise. Because if you're not adjusting for population, you're not getting a realistic view of how bad crime is. You know, there's way more muggings in the state of Texas than there are in the state of Massachusetts. Does it mean that crime is worse in Massachusetts than it is in Texas? Or the other way around? No. Because you have to adjust for population to get a realistic view of how bad the crime density is amongst the people that are living there. And this is really no different. When you're looking at the different states that have had mass shootings, they don't seem to have a pattern when it comes to whether or not the state has red flag laws or doesn't have red flag laws. There's been no statistical analysis that shows that these laws are in any way reducing mass shootings or gun crime in general. And even if there were stats that pointed that out, I still don't think that I would be in favor of it, and here's why. There's a great quote by Thomas Jefferson where he essentially said, I prefer a dangerous liberty to a secure tyranny. I mean, are these mass shootings and shooting events, are they horrific? Absolutely. Are they terrible? Yes. But even if gun control laws could stop them, and none of the stats show that they could, but even if that were the case, would it be better to have an occasional tragedy, as horrible as it is, or to live under a tyrannical state every single day? And if you want to answer that question, all you have to do is look around the globe. Look through history. Look at Cuba or Venezuela or the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany. All of those places, mass gun confiscation. And they lived under a tyrannical regime. And part of the reason that tyrannical regime was able to stay in power for as long as it did and murder lots of their own people, either by sheer incompetence or intentional starvation or intentional massacre, they were able to do so because they were dealing with an unarmed populace. Not saying that they wouldn't have been able to do it if the country weren't armed, but it wouldn't have been nearly as bad. Wouldn't have been nearly as easy to take over if that had been the case. And so, yes, these occasional tragedies, even though they're less common than they used to be, in the case of mass shootings, in the case of gun violence, specifically school shootings, I believe mass shootings have remained fairly constant. But anyway, in the light of all those things, they are horrible, and I want to do everything that we can to address them. But when you're looking at it, even if I had to choose between that and a tyrannical state that would possibly ensue in the absence of an armed populace, I'd have to go with the occasional tragedies, rather than living every single day under a tyrannical regime. If you're having to pick the lesser of two evils in that one, it would definitely be that one. That's why you always err on the side of liberty. And that brings me to a very odd place, but believe me, there's a reason that we're going here. You may remember over the weekend, there was a big stink caused over CNN anchor Chris Cuomo about it being called Fredo, and this guy walks up to Chris Cuomo, some random dude. Chris Cuomo was apparently eating there with his family, and then the guy walks up and refers to him as Fredo, which is a reference to The Godfather. It's the weak sort of whiny brother that he kind of talks tough, but he's not necessarily all that strong. That's what it's a reference to. It's intended as an insult. And this is just a sampling of the result because the whole video lasts like 4 or 5 minutes. This was Chris Cuomo's reaction to that.
What are you going to do about it?
I'll ruin you. I'll throw you down.
I thought that's who you were.
No, punk. Is from the right call me Fredo. My name is Chris Cuomo. I'm an anchor on CNN.
You're much
Fredo is from The Godfather. He was that weak brother.
Isn't that your
And
brother,
they use though? It as an Italian aspersion. Any of you Italian?
Are
you
Italian?
It's a insult to your people. It's an insult to your people. It's like the N-word for us. You can insult me like that.
I didn't insult
you. You call me Fredo. It's like I call you punk. You like that? You want that to be your nickname?
I didn't call you that.
You called me Fredo. You know my name. Fredo.
I thought your name was.
You did not think my name was Fredo. Don't be a liar. You want to be a man, stand up like a man.
I'm standing up, man.
You want to be a man up here.
Listen, take man, I have a problem with you, man.
Yeah, you're going to have a problem.
What? What are you going to do about it?
I'm going to ruin your shit. I can throw you down these stairs like a fucking.
Please do.
Why? So you can fucking sue?
You don't want
to. So you can fucking
sue? Why don't you do it?
Go take a swing. You want to call me Fredo? Take a
swing.
Take a
swing.
Watch your hands.
Okay, so a couple of takeaways from that. First of all, I think there are several things that can be true at once on this. And so I'll just kind of give a quick point by point. The first point, this dude is a huge jerk. And I'm not talking about Chris Cuomo, even though he's a huge jerk too, but we established that a long time ago on this program. This guy that walks up to him, I'm not sure exactly where they are, some kind of, I don't know, outdoor dinner or something. They appear to be under some kind of tent. But Chris Cuomo was there eating dinner with his family, and this random dude approaches him, flings an insult at him, and Chris Cuomo flies off the handle. That dude's a jerk. Because I do think that as a general rule, there should be a no-fire zone. You shouldn't just go up and intentionally be combative to somebody for no reason. And I've run into people that I have political disagreements with in the city of Montgomery. I mean, this is the capital city. There are occasionally members of Congress, the Senate, the House that I run across eating in a restaurant or whatever. That's a place that you don't go up and talk to somebody if you're going to be combative. Now, if it's somebody that's a buddy or a friend, somebody that's a political ally, or I would even say a political enemy and you intend to go over and be cordial to them, that's fine. But don't go up with the intention of starting a fight when a person is eating with their family. I mean, yeah, we've got freedom of speech in this country, and I fully support that. Still doesn't protect you from being a jerk. Was this guy allowed to do it? Sure. Should he have done it? No. This guy was intentionally being combative for no reason, and he's a huge jerk. The second point on this, even though guy number one is a huge jerk, Chris Cuomo handled it in pretty much the worst possible way. The only thing that would have been worse than the way that he handled it is if he had actually punched the guy. That's the only thing I can think of that would have made it worse. And so, you can't control what people do. And I've been in Chris Cuomo's shoes in that sense. I've had people walk up to me and insult me. I've had people walk up to me and be combative with me. It doesn't happen often. But it happens occasionally, people that don't like my political view. And I don't think I've ever had it quite that bad, but, you know, there are people that don't like me, and that's fine. I knew that that came with the territory when I got into this business. But the point is, Chris Cuomo handled it in absolutely the worst possible way. He took the bait, he got riled up, started yelling at the guy, started threatening him with physical violence. Which, again, only thing worse would have been if he'd actually slugged the guy. So Chris Cuomo did not handle it well. And I want you to ask yourself, if the shoe were on the other foot, let's take somebody that has a hot temper on the right. Sean Hannity, guy on News Radio 1440. The guy is kind of known for having a hot temper. If this had been Sean Hannity and some random dude walked up while Hannity was having dinner with his family and threw some kind of insult at him, whatever it may have been, I don't know. I don't even know what Hannity's ethnicity is, but let's say that that happened to Sean Hannity. Do you think the left would have been nearly as forgiving and rushed to Hannity's defense if he had reacted this way? Absolutely not. They would have been calling for the guy's job right away. And what's hilarious about this is in response to this, do you know what Sean Hannity did? He defended Chris Cuomo. Now, there have been lots of conservatives on both sides of the issue that have gone back and forth. I prefer Hannity's reaction, and this is weird, but I'm actually siding with Sean Hannity over Michael Knowles, which I don't do very often. But Michael Knowles essentially took the idea that, well, if Democrats want this, and this is going to be the world Democrats want to live in, then we have to be willing to fight back. I don't think that that excuses the man's behavior. I thought that Hannity's response might have been a little bit overly magnanimous. But the point is, I thought it was weird that I was actually siding more with Hannity than I did with Michael Knowles. That does not happen very often. But Hannity actually went on the air and uncategorically defended Chris Cuomo. Didn't say anything negative about Cuomo or how he reacted to it. Just flat out said, this guy's a jerk and we should denounce him. And so I find it hilarious that Hannity, a guy that is known for his temper, I mean, it's legendary. A guy that is known for, I don't know about necessarily losing it, but, you know, getting pretty riled up about political disagreements, more so than most, conservative or liberal, that even he says, nope, this was beyond the pale, and Chris Cuomo, he didn't say that what he was doing was right, he just didn't address the fact that Chris Cuomo's reaction to it was abysmal. And I thought that that was very big of Hannity, because Hannity has to know that if this exact same thing had happened to him, that would be all we would hear about for 3 or 4 days in the news cycle, and there would be people calling for his job. And that would be wrong. And it's wrong to call for Chris Cuomo's job because of this as well. And here's the third point. Cuomo and CNN have a massive, massive double standard when it comes to this. There's no question about that. And here's a little montage that was put together by Fox News to kind of showcase that.
There is a group of people, of politicos, who always hint that they might run but don't necessarily plunge all the way, and they are members of La Cuomo Nostra.
So who am I then, Fredo?
Daddy kept Fredo back home, so who cares what Donald Trump Jr. says?
Devin Nunes is proving himself again and again to be the Fredo of the Republican Party.
This guy, on these different occasions, basically tried to obstruct justice.
The fact that he was sage. Fredo, and nobody respected him enough to carry out his orders.
Oh, and of course, Fredo.
All right, so there's just a run of different people in the media using Fredo. And remember, in that clip where Chris Cuomo gets his dander up, he's saying that Fredo is an ethnic slur. It's the same as using the N-word for Italian people, which, first of all, I've never even heard of that. I mean, I've heard of The Godfather, but I haven't seen it, so I didn't know the character Fredo. And I've never heard of anyone using it as an insult towards Italian people. I don't have any Italian blood in me. There's not a ton of Italians running around South Alabama. So admittedly, I'm a little bit out of that culture, and it's not surprising to me that I've never heard it. Maybe it is a slur that people use. Maybe it's not. But here's the thing. If Chris Cuomo really believes that it's an ethnic slur, that it's beyond the pale and nobody should ever use it in polite society, then he obviously didn't believe it in 2010 where he used it himself, or just a few weeks ago on his own show where somebody used it to describe Donald Trump Jr. and you saw his reaction. He didn't react to it at all. He didn't praise it, but he also didn't denounce it. He didn't say, whoa, hold on. Well, if somebody said the N-word, I assume that Chris Cuomo would have said, nope, beyond the pale, you can't say that. First of all, because CNN would be very angry with that. But CNN came out with a public statement saying that Fredo was an ethnic slur, Chris Cuomo saying the same thing in that clip. But yet when somebody actually uses it against someone that Chris Cuomo doesn't like on his own show, well, that's perfectly fine. And then you saw somebody on Anderson Cooper uses the same insult. Then you've got Bill Maher, which isn't on CNN, but certainly somebody on the left. Nobody freaked out about Bill Maher using an ethnic slur. So all of these things are true. That this guy's a massive jerk that went up and just started trying to wail on Chris Cuomo. Chris Cuomo, also a massive jerk and did not react to it well. And then finally, the media has a very obvious double standard when it comes to this. Remember, this is the same guy, Chris Cuomo, who got so upset at somebody calling him Fredo. He's the one that was saying that little girls in a locker room that don't want to see a full-grown man's junk, that girl's a bigot and her father's a bigot for not teaching her tolerance. That's Chris Cuomo saying that, oh, Fredo's beyond the pale, but that's perfectly okay. I mean, he's also the guy that said that girls were bigots for not wanting to compete with a roided out wrestler that was on steroid shots in Texas. He's also the same guy that said that Antifa, that their violence really isn't as bad as violence from other groups because they're at least fighting a good fight. The guy's just an absolute piece of human garbage. He's nothing but a political pundit that pretends to be a journalist. And when stuff like this happens, he shows his true colors. Because he'll freak out over anybody that disagrees with him saying something, and he'll immediately go to, well, that's beyond the pale and we should never do that, even though he's done it himself. And he thinks that little girls that don't want to see a full-grown man's organs, that's somebody that should be cast out of polite society. The double standards just blow my mind. Anyway, in response to this, and this is where the gun tie-in comes in. In response to this, President Trump tweeted this out. Well, if it ever actually pops up. Here we go. President Trump. Would Chris Cuomo be given a red flag for his recent rant? Filthy language and total loss of control. He shouldn't be allowed to have any weapon. He's nuts, okay? Okay, I added the okay. Now, when I first read this tweet, I chuckled. Because I thought about it, I was like, yeah, maybe that'll get Chris Cuomo to rethink his support of red flag laws. And then I realized that President Trump's not doing it for that reason. Now, I hate to assign motive, but then I remembered that President Trump's actually proposing red flag laws and is behind them. And like I said, still willing to hear the president out, still want to hear what he has to say on his suggestions. But this gives us a hint into where Trump's mind is on red flag laws, that he's actually suggesting that red flag laws would be a good thing, and then comes out with this tweet that suggests that what Trump is saying is people that he believes are unhinged or crazy should not be allowed to own firearms. And the very first person that he suggests might be a candidate for being blocked by this kind of law is someone who is his political adversary. This is a perfect example of why the left should not be supporting these laws. And I actually made this case not on red flag laws specifically, but on gun control in general, just a few shows ago. If you're on the left and you really believe all these terrible things about President Trump, that he's a Nazi, that he's literally running concentration camps, that he's a racist, all of those terrible things, why on earth would you want the federal government determining whether or not you should be allowed to have a gun? That is insane. And what we just saw on display, President Trump suggesting that somebody who does not like him politically very much, I think that's safe to say with Chris Cuomo, if you've been paying any attention to him, somebody that is his political adversary, saying that guy should be kept from having a gun, that guy shouldn't be allowed to have a weapon to defend himself. That's terrifying. That is so far beyond the pale, and it shows exactly why red flag laws are dangerous. A person need only be suspicious of someone. A person need only believe that someone might be capable of committing an act of violence to get that person's God-given constitutional rights taken away from them. And that's the reason why I cannot support these red flag laws. And if this is actually where President Trump's mind is when it comes to these red flag laws, that should horrify everybody on the right and left. To people on the left, why are you in such a rush to surrender your liberties to Donald Trump? Why would you speedily champion a path forward to a red flag law where ultimately Congress and President Trump are the ones that are deciding whether or not your guns are taken away? Because keep in mind, yes, the law may be crafted in Congress, but who is in charge of enforcing those laws? The executive branch. In other words, President Trump and his chosen cabinet and administrators. Do you really want that guy having the final say as to whether or not you get to have a gun or not? Because it seems that President Trump is all too willing to take away guns from those who he does not politically agree with, as long as he can catch them on camera saying crazy things or yelling. Now, granted, in Chris Cuomo's case, this doesn't look good, but I didn't see anything in that video that would lead me to think, yeah, that guy probably shouldn't have a gun. Nothing. Because he didn't commit a crime. He didn't threaten anybody with a gun. He threatened them. But even then, I didn't think that it rose to the level of criminality. But to the right. And I know that I'm speaking a little bit more directly to you because I'm on your side. This is the example. This is the reason why you should not support a red flag law just because President Trump is the one that's touting it. You can't just support a policy because of the person that is rolling it out. You have to support it based on the idea and the merit of the policy itself. If you support this law simply because President Trump is the one that is rolling it out, the one that is supporting it, then you are absolutely the authoritarian fascist that the left claims that you are. If that's really what you believe, if you're thinking, well, it's okay to take away other people's liberties as long as I disagree with them, then I'm sorry, you are the right-leaning fascist that's trying to keep out any kind of political disagreement, keep out any kind of other ideas that don't line up with yours that they claim that you are for. You are the fascist that they're claiming you are, if you believe that. And if you're doing it specifically because Donald Trump is the one that's saying it's okay, then you're not only a fascist, you're falling into the cult of personality. Red flag laws are a challenge to liberty everywhere. Now, it looks like I've just about run out of time, and I hate that because I had a daily dose of stupid and a chaplain's report. But before we break today, because I have to go do something else for the university, before we break today, I did have some really good news, and it won't take me long to get into this. Unplanned, the movie that came out about Planned Parenthood, has risen to the number one sold DVD on Amazon. Now, it didn't top the Blu-ray list because Avengers Endgame came out the same week, which I gotta admit, it was pretty bold for them to release on the same week of Avengers Endgame. It's the most profitable movie in all of history when it comes to box office numbers. But Avengers Endgame broke, so it definitely topped the Blu-ray sales. But Unplanned became the number one movie in America when it came to DVD sales on the Amazon list. And that's not for a specific genre, that's overall. So I'm just going to leave you with a little snippet of this. This is actually a trailer for Unplanned. If you have not seen it, I cannot recommend it highly enough. Would like to go ahead and show this to you just so you get an idea of what the movie's about.
Abby Johnson is in the other room.
Here.
Our first order of business is to present Planned Parenthood's Employee of the Year Award. Abby Johnson.
There's a fire inside, you can feel.
This is Abby. She's our newest volunteer escort.
Abby, this is Cheryl D'Alessandro.
I'd be the youngest director in Planned Parenthood history.
You'll actually be in charge of the abortions at your clinic?
I have a chance to make a real difference.
No matter what you do for the rest of your life, you're still going to be a baby killer.
The only thing that's changed is you, Abby. Can you even hear yourself talk right now about these procedures? These are little babies.
I'm not going to apologize for doing a job that helps women in crisis.
There's still a part of me that isn't sure.
I know. But the one thing that all experts agree on is that at this stage, the fetus can't feel anything.
Sorry to bother you, but they need an extra person in the back room. Are you free?
I saw it. It was like it was twisting and fighting for its life.
We commend the souls of these hundreds of children. And Lord, we pray to end abortion.
I really appreciate what you've done for us. I'll not forget it.
22,000 abortions. How do I even comprehend that?
Rough day at the office.
You can say that. You're making a mess.
It's your dad and me. You are our baby from the moment of conception.
We are paying you to be a perfect instrument of corporate policy. We are an abortion provider.
I can't be a part of this anymore. Everything that they told us is a lie.
Don't underestimate the repercussions of this. You gotta be careful.
Rhonda, please, don't do this! Rhonda!
Let me tell you what's gonna happen if you walk through that door.
Congratulations, you've made an enemy of one of the most powerful organizations on the planet.
All right, so that's just a trailer to give you an idea of what the movie's about. If you haven't seen it yet, I highly, highly recommend it. It's on Blu-ray and DVD. I already got the Blu-ray the other day, and this is just a phenomenal movie. I'm going to warn you, it's a hard-hitting movie. You don't go into this one casually. It's hard to watch, but it's worth it because of the message that is presented there, and it's not a downer. Like, you don't walk away from that movie feeling like the world's a terrible place. It does have a good ending. It does have an uplifting ending. But I'm just warning you ahead of time, it's a tough watch. It's kind of like The Passion of the Christ. You don't go into it lightly. Yes, the takeaway is good, but there's some gut-wrenching scenes, and you just need to be aware of that. But the fact that it has already grossed, according to the latest figures, $18 million is absolutely astounding. This is a movie that had a $6 million budget. So it's already tripled its profits. Tripled its own budget. It's already made double what was spent on it. And so, I can't even communicate to you as somebody who studies film how amazing it is. It kind of reminds me of, and I know that these two movies are not at all similar in any way when you're talking about theme and purpose. It's kind of like Napoleon Dynamite. It's one of those movies that had a very, very tiny budget and yet somehow just exploded and made a lot more money than it is. And I think that a lot of that goes back to this idea that the truth is, when it comes to this fight on abortion, and I think that Unplanned is more of a, I think that it helped with this, but it's not the only reason. I think a lot of it had to do with New York's abortion law. But it seems to me that Christians are finally waking up and willing to fight, because for the longest time, Christians have always been against abortion overall, but they'd kind of fallen asleep at the wheel and kind of just thought of that as a battle that was already lost. I'm seeing a lot of Christians that are not politically savvy, that don't watch an awful lot of news, that are standing up and willing to fight for this that I have not seen in my lifetime. And I'm hoping that that is a sign that the end of abortion is coming. I really do. I'm very optimistic about it. I've been praying about it. I hope that you have too. I think that the end is in sight. And I think before I die, within my lifetime, abortion will be made illegal in all 50 states. I hope that that comes to pass. But finally, Christians are awake and they're willing to stand up for what is right. I think it's been a great shame to us that we haven't done that for a long time. I hope that those of you within the sound of my voice have been people that have been willing to take that stand the whole time. But a lot of Christians haven't. And I'm glad to see that that is finally changing. Like I said, we're about out of time. It's already a little bit past 8 o'clock, so I actually have a meeting I've got to get to. But thank you so much for being with us. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics is a production of News Radio 1440 and Cumulus Media Montgomery. Any opinions expressed on this program are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Cumulus Media. The theme song for Tactics is 6 Foot Town by Big and Rich. Graphics by Jessica Dawson. Broadcast studios provided by Cumulus Media Montgomery. Location studios provided by the Dalreda Church of Christ. Copyright 2019.